The Art of War by Niccolo Machiavelli. Book 4. Luigi said, "Since an engagement has been won so honourably under my rule, I think it is well if I do not tempt fortune further, knowing how changeable and unstable it is. And therefore I desire to resign my speakership, and that, wanting to follow the order that belongs to the youngest, Zanobi now assume this office of questioning. And I know he will not refuse this honour, or we would rather say this hard work, as much in order to give pleasure as also because he is naturally more courageous than I. Nor should he be afraid to enter into these labours, where he can thus be overcome as he can overcome." Zanobi said, "I intend to stay where you put me, even though I would more willingly stay to listen, because up to now I am more satisfied with your questions than those which occurred to me in listening to your discussions pleased me. But I believe it is well, lords, since you have time left and have patience, we do not annoy you with these ceremonies of ours." Fabrizio said, "Rather you give me pleasure, because this change of questioners makes me know the various geniuses and your various desires. Is there anything remaining of the matter discussed which you think should be added?" Zanobi said, "There are two things I desire before we pass on to another part. The one is that you would show me if there is another form of organizing the army which may occur to you. The other, what considerations ought a captain have before going to battle? And if some accident should arise concerning it, what remedies can be made?" Fabrizio said, "I will make an effort to satisfy you. I will not reply to your questions in detail, for when I answer one, often it will also answer another. I have told you that I proposed a form for the army which should fill all the requirements according to the nature of the enemy and the site, because in this case one proceeds according to the site and the enemy. But note this, that there is no greater peril than to overextend the front of your army, unless you have a very large and very brave army. Otherwise you have to make it rather wide and of short length than of long length and very narrow. For when you have a small force compared to the enemy, you ought to seek other remedies. For example, arrange your army so that you are girded on a side by rivers or swamps, so that you cannot be surrounded, or gird yourself on the flanks with ditches, as Caesar did in Gaul. In this case, you have to take the flexibility of being able to enlarge or compress your front, according to the numbers of the enemy. And if the enemy is of a lesser number, you ought to seek wide places, especially if you have your forces so disciplined that you are able not only to surround the enemy, but extend your ranks. Because in rough and difficult places you do not have the advantage of being able to avail yourself of all your ranks. Hence it happened that the Romans almost always sought open fields, and avoided the difficult ones. On the other hand, as I have said, you ought, if you have either a small force or a poorly disciplined one, to seek places where a small number can defend you, or where inexperience may not cause you injury. Also, higher places ought to be sought, so as to be able more easily to attack the enemy. And nonetheless, one ought to be aware not to arrange your army on a beach, and in a place near the adjoining hills, where an enemy army can come. Because in this case, with respect to the artillery, the higher place would be disadvantageous to you, because you could continuously and conveniently be harmed by the enemy artillery, without being able to undertake any remedy, and similarly, impeded by your own men, you cannot conveniently injure him. Whoever organizes an army for battle ought also to have regard for both the sun and the wind, that the one and the other do not strike the front, because both impede your vision, the one with its rays, the other with dust. And in addition, the wind does not aid the arms that are thrown at the enemy, and makes their blows more feeble. And as to the sun, it is not enough that you take care that it is not in your face at the time, but you must think about it not harming you when it comes up. And because of this, in arranging the army, I would have the sun behind them, so that much time should pass before it should come in front of you. This method was observed by Hannibal at Cannae, and by Marius against the Cimbrians. If you should be greatly inferior in cavalry, arrange your army between vines and trees and such impediments, as the Spaniards did in our time when they routed the French in the kingdom of Naples on the Cerignola. and it has been frequently seen that the same soldiers, when they changed only their arrangement and location, from being overcome became victorious, as happened to the Carthaginians, who, after having been often defeated by Marius Regulus, were afterwards victorious through the counsel of Xantippe, the Lacedaemonian, who had them descend to the plain, where, by virtue of their cavalry and elephants, they were able to overcome the Romans. And it appears to me, according to the examples of the ancients, that almost all the excellent captains, when they learned that the enemy had strengthened one side of the company, did not attack the stronger side, but the weaker, and to the other stronger side they opposed to the weaker. Then, when starting a battle, they cornered the stronger part, that it only resist the enemy, and not push it back, and the weaker part that it allow itself to be overcome, and retire into the rear ranks of the army. This causes two great disorders to the enemy. The first, that he finds his stronger part surrounded. The second is that, as it appears to them they will obtain victory quickly, it rarely happens that he will not become disorganized, whence his defeat quickly results. Cornelius Scipio, when he was in Spain, fighting against Hasdrubal the Carthaginian, and knowing that Hasdrubal, in arranging the army, placed his legions in the centre, which constituted the strongest part of his army, and therefore when Hasdrubal was to proceed in this manner afterwards, when he came to the engagement, changed the arrangement, and put his legions in the wings of the army, and placed his weaker forces in the centre. Then, when they came hand to hand, he quickly had those forces in the centre to walk slowly, and the wings to move forward swiftly, so that only the wings of both armies fought, and the ranks in the centre, being distant from each other, did not join in battle. And thus the strongest part of the army of Scipio came to fight the weakest part of that of Hasdrubal, and defeated it. This method at that time was useful, but today, because of the artillery, could not be employed, because that space that existed between one and the other army gives them time to fire, which is most pernicious, as was said above. This method, therefore, must be set aside, and be used, as was said a short time ago, when all the army is engaged, and the weaker part made to yield. When a captain finds himself to have an army larger than that of the enemy, and not wanting to be prevented from surrounding him, arranges his army with fronts equal to those of the enemy, and when the battle is started, has his front retire, and the flanks extend little by little, and it will always happen that the enemy will find himself surrounded without being aware of it. When a captain wants to fight almost secure in not being routed, he arranges his army in a place where he has a safe refuge nearby, either amid swamps or mountains or in a powerful city. For in this manner he cannot be pursued by the enemy. But the enemy cannot be pursued by him. This means was employed by Hannibal when fortune began to become adverse for him, and he was apprehensive of the valour of Marcus Marcellus. Several, in order to disorganize the ranks of the enemy, have commanded those who are lightly armed that they begin the fight, and having begun it, retire among the ranks. Then when the armies afterwards have joined fronts together, and each front is occupied in fighting, they have allowed them to issue forth from the flanks of the companies, and disorganized and routed them. If anyone finds himself inferior in cavalry, he can, in addition to the methods mentioned, place a company of pikemen behind his cavalry, and in the fighting arrange for them to give way for the pikemen, and he will always remain superior. Many have accustomed some of the lightly armed infantry to get used to combat amidst the cavalry, and this has been a very great help to the cavalry. Of all those who have organized armies for battle, the most praiseworthy have been Hannibal and Scipio when they were fighting in Africa. And as Hannibal had his army composed of Carthaginians and auxiliaries of various kinds, he placed 80 elephants in the front van, and then placed the auxiliaries. After these he placed the Carthaginians, and in the rear he placed the Italians, whom he trusted little. He arranged matters thusly, because the auxiliaries, having the enemy in front and their rear closed by his men, they could not flee, so that being compelled to fight, they should overcome or tire out the Romans, thinking afterwards, with his forces of virtue fresh, he could easily overcome the already tired Romans. In the encounter with this arrangement, Scipio placed the Astarte, the Principe, and the Triarii in the accustomed fashion, for one to be able to receive the other, and one to help the other. He made the vans of the army full of intervals, and so that they should not be seen through, but rather appear united, he filled them with Veliti, whom he commanded that, as soon as the elephants arrived, they should give way, and enter through the regular spaces among the legions, and leave the way open to the elephants, and thus come to render the attack vain, so that coming hand to hand with him, he was superior. Zenobe said, "You have made me remember, in telling me of this engagement, that Scipio, during the fight, did not have the Astarte retire into the ranks of the Principi, but divided them, and had them retire into the wings of the army, so as to make room for the Principi if he wanted to push them forward. I would desire, therefore, that you tell me what reason motivated him not to observe the accustomed arrangement." Fabrizio said, "I will tell you. Hannibal had placed all the virtue of his army in the second line, whence Scipio, in order to oppose a similar virtue to it, assembled the Principi and the Triarii, so that the intervals of the Principi being occupied by the Triarii, there was no place to receive the Astarte, and therefore he caused the Astarte to be divided and enter the wings of the army, and did not bring them among the Principi. But take note that this method of opening up the first lines to make a place for the second cannot be employed except when the other are superior, because then the convenience exists to be able to do it, as Scipio was able to. But being inferior and repulsed, it cannot be done except with your manifest ruin. And therefore you must have ranks in the rear which will receive you. But let us return to our discussion. The ancient Asiatics, among other things thought up by them to injure the enemy, used chariots which had scythes on their sides, so that they not only served to open up the lines with their attack, but also kill the adversary with the scythes. Provisions against these attacks were made in three ways. It was resisted by the density of the ranks, or they were received within the lines, as were the elephants, or a stalwart resistance was made with some stratagems, as did Sulla the Roman, against Archelaus, who had many of those chariots which they called Falcati. He, Sulla, in order to resist them, fixed many poles in the ground behind the first ranks, by which the chariots, being resisted, lost their impetus. And note is to be taken of the new method which Sulla used against this man in arranging the army, since he put the Veliti and the cavalry in the rear, and all the heavily armed in front, leaving many intervals in order to be able to send those in the rear forward if necessity should require it. Whence, when the battle was started, with the aid of the cavalry, to whom he gave the way, he obtained the victory. To want to worry the enemy during the battle, something must be made to happen which dismays him, either by announcing new help which is arriving, or by showing things which look like it, so that the enemy, being deceived by that sight, becomes frightened. And when he is frightened, he can be easily overcome. These methods were used by the Roman consuls Minucius Rufus and Icilius Glabrius. Caius Sulpicius also placed many soldier packs on mules and other animals useless in war, but in a manner that they looked like men-at-arms, and commanded that they appear on a hill while they were in hand-to-hand combat with the Gauls, whence his victory resulted. Marius did the same when he was fighting against the Germans. Feigned assaults, therefore, being of great value while the battle lasts, it happens that many are benefited by the real assaults, especially if, improvised in the middle of the battle, it is able to attack the enemy from behind or on the sides, which can be done only with difficulty unless the nature of the company helps you. For if it is open, part of your forces cannot be speeded, as must be done in such enterprises. But in wooded or mountainous places, and hence capable of ambush, part of your forces can be well hidden, so that the enemy may be assaulted suddenly and without his expecting it, which will always be the cause of giving you the victory. And sometimes it has been very important, while the battle goes on, to plant voices which announce the death of the enemy captain, or the defeat of some other part of the army. And this often has given the victory to whoever used it. The enemy cavalry may be easily disturbed by unusual sights or noises, as did Croesus, who opposed camels to the cavalry of his adversaries, and Pyrrhus, who opposed elephants to the Roman cavalry, the sight of which disturbed and disorganized it. In our times, the Turk routed the Shah in Persia and the Soldan in Syria with nothing else than the noise of guns, which so affected their cavalry by their unaccustomed noises that the Turk was able easily to defeat it. The Spaniards, to overcome the army of Hamilcar, placed in their first lines chariots full of tow drawn by oxen, and when they had come to battle, set fire to them, whence the oxen, wanting to flee the fire, hurled themselves on the army of Hamilcar and dispersed it. As we mentioned, where the country is suitable, it is usual to deceive the enemy when in combat by drawing him into ambushes. But when it is open and spacious, many have employed the digging of ditches, and then covering them lightly with earth and branches, but leaving several spaces solid, in order to be able to retire between them. Then, when the battle is started, retire through them, and the enemy pursuing comes to ruin in them. If, during the battle, some accident befalls you which dismays your soldiers, it is a most prudent thing to know how to dissimulate and divert them to something good, as did Lucius Sulla, who, while the fighting was going on, seeing that a great part of his forces had gone over to the side of the enemy, and that this had dismayed his men, quickly caused it to be understood throughout the entire army that everything was happening by his order. And this not only did not disturb the army, but so increased its courage that it was victorious. It also happened to Sulla that, having sent certain soldiers to undertake certain business, and they having been killed, in order that his army would not be dismayed, said that because he had found them unfaithful, he had cunningly sent them into the hands of the enemy. Sertorius, when undertaking an engagement in Spain, killed one who had pointed out to him the slaying of one of his heads, for fear that by telling the same to others he should dismay them. It is a difficult matter to stop an army already in flight and return it to battle. And you have to make this distinction: either they are entirely in flight, and here it is impossible to return them, or only a part are in flight, and here there is some remedy. Many Roman captains, by getting in front of those fleeing, have stopped them, by making them ashamed of their flight, as did Lucius Sulla, who, when a part of his legions had already turned, driven by the forces of Mithridates, with his sword in hand he got in front of them and shouted, "If anyone asks you where you have left your captain, tell them we have left him in Boeotia, fighting." The consul Attilius opposed those who fled with those who did not flee, and made them understand that if they did not turn about, they would be killed by both friends and enemies. Philip of Macedonia, when he learned that his men were afraid of the Scythian soldiers, put some of his most trusted cavalry behind his army, and commissioned them to kill anyone who fled. Whence his men, preferring to die fighting rather than in flight, won. Many Romans, not so much in order to stop a flight as to give his men an occasion to exhibit greater prowess while they were fighting, have taken a banner out of their hands, and tossing it amid the enemy, offered rewards to whoever would retrieve it. I do not believe it is out of order to add to this discussion those things that happen after a battle, especially as they are brief, and not to be omitted, and conform greatly to this discussion. I will tell you, therefore, how engagements are lost or are won. When one wins, he ought to follow up the victory with all speed, and imitate Caesar in this case, and not Hannibal, who, because he had stopped after he had defeated the Romans at Cannae, lost the empire of Rome. The other, Caesar, never rested after a victory, but pursued the routed army with great impetus and fury until he had completely assaulted it. But when one loses, a captain ought to see if something useful can result from this loss, especially if some residue of the army remains to him. An opportunity can arise from the unawareness of the enemy, which frequently becomes obscured after a victory, and gives you the occasion to attack him. As Martius, the Roman, attacked the Carthaginian army, which, having killed the two Scipios and defeated their armies, thought little of that remnant of the forces, who, with Martius, remained alive, and was in turn attacked and routed by him. It is seen, therefore, that there is nothing so capable of success as that which the enemy believes you cannot attempt, because men are often injured more when they are less apprehensive. A captain ought, therefore, when he cannot do this, at least endeavour with industry to restrict the injury caused by the defeat. And to do this, it is necessary for you to take steps that the enemy is not able to follow you easily, or give him cause for delay. In the first case, some, after they realize they are losing, order their leaders to flee to several parts by different paths, having first given an order where they should afterwards reassemble, so that the enemy, fearing to divide his forces, would leave all or a greater part of them safe. In the second case, many have thrown down their most precious possessions in front of the enemy, so that, being retarded by plundering, he gave them more time for flight. Titus Dimius used not a little astuteness in hiding the injury received in battle, for, after he had fought until nightfall with the loss of many of his men, caused a good many of them to be buried during the night, whence in the morning the enemy, seeing so many of their dead and so few Romans, believing they had the disadvantage, fled. I believe I have thus confused you, as I said, but satisfied your question in good part. It is true that concerning the shape of the army, there remains for me to tell you how sometimes it is customary for some captains to make the front in the form of a wedge, judging in that way to be more able readily to penetrate the army of the enemy. In opposition to this shape, they customarily would form a scissor, so as to be able to receive that wedge into that space, and surround and fight it from every side. On this, I would like you to have this general rule, that the greatest remedy used against the design of the enemy is to do that willingly which he designs for you to do by force, because, doing it willingly, you do it with order and to your advantage, but to his disadvantage. If you should do it by force, it would be to your ruin. As to the fortifying of this, I would not care to repeat anything already said. Does the adversary make a wedge in order to open your ranks? If you proceed with yours open, you disorganize him, and he does not disorganize you. Hannibal placed elephants in front of his army to open that of the army of Scipio. Scipio went with his open, and was the cause of his own victory, and the ruin of Hannibal. Hasdrubal placed his most stalwart forces in the centre of the van of his army to push back the forces of Scipio. Scipio commanded in like fashion that they should retire, and defeated him. So that such plans, when they are put forward, are the cause of the victory of him against whom they were organized. It remains for me yet, if I remember well, to tell you what considerations a captain ought to take into account before going into battle. Upon which I have to tell you first that a captain never has to make an engagement if he does not have the advantage, or if he is not compelled to. Advantages arise from the location, from the organization, and from having either greater or better forces. Necessity or compulsion arises when you see that by not fighting you must lose in any event. For example, when you see you are about to lack money, and therefore your army has to be dissolved in any case, when hunger is about to assail you, or when you expect the enemy to be reinforced again by new forces. In these cases one ought always to fight, even at your disadvantage, for it is much better to try your fortune when it can favour you, than by not trying when you see your ruin sure. And in such a case it is as serious an error for a captain not to fight, as it is to pass up an opportunity to win, either from ignorance or from cowardice. The enemy sometimes gives you the advantage, and sometimes it derives from your prudence. Many have been routed while crossing a river by an alert enemy of theirs, who waited until they were in the middle of the stream, and then assaulted them on every side, as Caesar did to the Swiss, when he destroyed a fourth part of them after they had been split by the river. Sometime you may find your enemy tired from having pursued you too inconsiderately, so that, finding yourself fresh and rested, you ought not to lose such an opportunity. In addition to this, if an enemy offers you battle at a good hour of the morning, you can delay going out of your encampment for many hours. and if he has been under arms for a long time, and has lost that first ardour with which he started, you can then fight with him. Scipio and Metellus employed this method in Spain, the first against Hasdrubal, and the other against Sertorius. If the enemy had diminished in strength, either from having divided the armies, as the Scipios did in Spain, or from some other cause, you ought to try your fortune. The greater part of prudent captains would rather receive the onrush of the enemy, who impetuously go to assault them, for their fury is easily withstood by firm and resolute men, and that fury which was withstood easily converts itself into cowardice. Fabius acted thusly against the Samnites, and against the Gauls, and was victorious, but his colleague Decius was killed. Some who feared the virtue of their enemy have begun the battle at an hour near nightfall, so that if their men were defeated, they might be able to be protected by its darkness and save themselves. Some, having known that the enemy army, because of certain superstitions, does not want to undertake fighting at such a time, selected that time for battle, and won, which Caesar did in Gaul against Ariovistus, and Vespasianus in Syria against the Jews. The greater and more important awareness that a captain ought to have is to see that he has about him men loyal and most expert in war, and prudent, with whom he counsels continuously, and discusses his forces and those of the enemy with them. Which are the greater in number? Which are better armed or better trained? Which are more apt to suffer deprivation? Which to confide in more, the infantry or the cavalry? Also they consider the location in which they are, and if it is more suitable for the enemy than for themselves. Which of them has the better convenience of supply? Whether it is better to delay the engagement or undertake it? And what benefit the weather might give you or take away from them? For often, when the soldiers see the war becoming long, they become irritable, and, weary from hard work and tedium, will abandon you. Above all, it is important for the captain to know the enemy, and who he has around him, if he is foolhardy or cautious, if timid or audacious. See whether you can trust the auxiliary soldiers, and above all, you ought to guard against leading an army into battle which is afraid or distrustful in any way of victory, for the best indication of defeat is when one believes he cannot win. And therefore, in this case, you ought to avoid an engagement, either by doing as Fabius Maximus did, who, by encamping in strong places, did not give Hannibal courage to go and meet him, or by believing that the enemy, also in strong places, should come to meet you. You should depart from the field, and divide your forces among your towns, so that the tedium of capturing them will tire him. Zenobi said, "Can he not avoid the engagement in other ways than by dividing the army into several parts, and putting them in towns?" Fabrizio said, "I believe at another time I have discussed with some of you that whoever is in the field cannot avoid an engagement if he has an enemy who wants to fight in any case. And he has but one remedy, and that is to place himself, with his army, at least 50 miles distant from his adversary, so as to be in time to get out of his way if he should come to meet him. And Fabius Maximus never avoided an engagement with Hannibal, but wanted it at his advantage. And Hannibal did not presume to be able to overcome him by going to meet him in the places where he encamped. But if he supposed he could defeat him, it was necessary for Fabius to undertake an engagement with him in any case, or to flee. Philip, king of Macedonia, he who was the father of Perseus, coming to war with the Romans, placed his encampment on a very high mountain, so as not to have an engagement with them. But the Romans went to meet him on that mountain and routed him. Vercingetorix, a captain of the Gauls, in order to avoid an engagement with Caesar, who unexpectedly had crossed the river, placed himself miles distant with his forces. The Venetians, in our times, if they did not want to come to an engagement with the King of France, ought not to have waited until the French army had crossed the Adda, but should have placed themselves distant from him, as did Vercingetorix. Whence, having waited for him, they did not know how to take the opportunity of undertaking an engagement during the crossing, nor how to avoid it. For the French being near to them, as the Venetians decamped, assaulted and routed them. And so it is that an engagement cannot be avoided if the enemy at all events wants to undertake it. Nor does any one cite Fabius, for he avoided an engagement in cases like that just as much as did Hannibal. It often happens that your soldiers are not willing to fight, and you know that because of their number or the location, or from some other cause, you have a disadvantage, and would like them to change their minds. It also happens that necessity or opportunity constrains you to come to an engagement, and that your soldiers are discontent and little disposed to fight, whence it is necessary for you, in one case, to frighten them, and in the other, to excite them. In the first instance, if persuasion is not enough, there is no better way to have both those who fight and those who would not believe you than to give some of them over to the enemy as plunder. It may also be well to do with cunning that which happened to Fabius Maximus at home. The army of Fabius desired, as you know, to fight with the army of Hannibal. His master of cavalry had the same desire. It did not seem proper to Fabius to attempt the battle, so that, in order to dispel such desires, he had to divide the army. Fabius kept his men in the encampments, and the other, the master of cavalry, going forth and coming into great danger, would have been routed if Fabius had not succoured him. By this example, the master of the cavalry, together with the entire army, realized it was a wise course to obey Fabius. As to exciting them to fight, it is well to make them angry at the enemy, by pointing out that the enemy say slanderous things of them, and showing them to have with their intelligence in the enemy camp, and having corrupted some part, to encamp on the side where they see the enemy, and undertake some light skirmishes with them, because things that are seen daily are more easily disparaged. By showing yourself indignant, and by making an oration in which you reproach them for their laziness, you make them so ashamed by seeing you want to fight only if they do not accompany you. And above everything, to have this awareness, if you want to make the soldiers obstinate in battle, not to permit them to send home any of their possessions, or settle in any place, until the war ends, so that they understand that if flight saves them their lives, it will not save them their possessions. The love of the latter, not less than the former, renders men obstinate in defence. Zenobi said, "You have told how soldiers can be made to turn and fight, by talking to them. Do you mean by this that he has to talk to the entire army, or to its heads?" Fabrizio said, "To persuade or dissuade a few from something is very easy, for if words are not enough, you can use authority and force. But the difficulty is to take away a sinister idea from a multitude, whether it may be in agreement or contrary to your own opinion, where only words can be used, which, if you want to persuade everyone, must be heard by everyone. Captains, therefore, must be excellent orators, for without knowing how to talk to the entire army, good things can only be done with difficulty, which, in these times of ours, is completely done away with. Read the biography of Alexander the Great, and see how many times it was necessary to harangue and speak publicly to the army. Otherwise, he could never have led them, having become rich and full of plunder, through the deserts of Arabia and into India, with so much hardship and trouble. For infinite numbers of things arose by which an army is ruined if a captain does not know how, or is not accustomed to talking to it. For this speaking takes away fear, incites courage, increases obstinacy, and sweeps away deceptions, promises rewards, points out dangers and the ways to avoid them, reprimands, begs, threatens, fills with hope, praises, slanders, and does away all those things by which human passion are extinguished or enkindled. Whence that prince or republic planning to raise a new army, and to give this army reputation, ought to accustom the soldiers to listen to the talk of the captain, and the captain to know how to talk to them. Religion was also of much value in keeping the ancient soldiers well disposed, and an oath was taken by them when they came into the army. For whenever they made a mistake, they were threatened not only by those evils that can be feared by men, but also by those that can be expected from the deity. This practice, mixed with other religious means, often made an entire enterprise easy for the ancient captains, and would always be so whenever religion was feared and observed. Sertorius availed himself of this when he told of talking with a hind or female stag, which promised him victory on the part of the deity. Sulla was said to talk with a statue which he had taken from the temple of Apollo. Many have told of God appearing to them in their sleep and admonishing them to fight. In the times of our fathers, Charles VII, King of France, in the war he waged against the English, was said to counsel with a young girl sent by God, who was called the Maid of France, and who was the cause for victory. You can also take means to make your soldiers value the enemy little, as Agesilaus the Spartan did, who showed his soldiers some Persians in the nude, so that, seeing their delicate members, they should have no cause for being afraid of them. Some have constrained them to fight from necessity, by removing from their paths all hope of saving themselves, except through victory. This is the strongest and the best provision that can be made when you want to make your soldiers obstinate, which obstinacy is increased by the confidence and the love either of the captain or of the country. Confidence is instilled by arms organization, fresh victories, and the knowledge of the captain. Love of country springs from nature, that of the captain from his virtue more than any other good event. Necessities can be many, but that is the strongest which constrains you either to win or to die.